From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. When we talk about water on this program, it's usually in terms of the Colorado River and how much water is in Lake Mead. But Nevada is also incredibly reliant on groundwater, and that's causing issues. A recent study published in Hydrological Process found that thousands of wells across Nevada have experienced significant declines over the last three decades. So how do you limit the use of groundwater in a way that's fair for all? One proposed solution is a state program aimed at incentivizing the retirement of water rights. Daniel Rothberg covered this program for a joint story by the Daily Yonder and Nevada Public Radio's Desert Companion magazine. Rothberg is a journalist whose Substack, Invisible Waters, focuses on water issues across the western U.S. Here's that conversation. Daniel, first off, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
How reliant is Nevada on groundwater?
People don't think about groundwater as much as they might think about surface water like the Truckee River or the Colorado River, but a lot of communities across the West are heavily dependent on groundwater, especially in rural communities in Nevada. Agricultural communities are very dependent on groundwater, both for municipal water supply and for agricultural water supplies. Groundwater developed a little bit later in Nevada after surface water developed in most cases, but it became a very, very important water supply starting in about the 1950s and has become even more so since then.
So let's talk about this water buyback program that the state devised in 2023. How does it work?
The Groundwater Rights Retirement Program provided entities around the state that are involved in managing groundwater a particular amount of funding. It varied from entity to entity to purchase water rights on a voluntary basis from irrigators with the hopes that once they purchase the water right, they could retire it permanently, taking it off of the books. That means that in the accounting ledger, if you kind of think of a basin as having a budget, you can look at the total amount of pumping. And if the total amount of pumping exceeds the amount of water that is naturally replenished back into the basin, that means that there's more pumping than is sustainable. The Groundwater Rights Retirement Program looks to reduce the total amount of pumping that is occurring in the basin by actually going in, purchasing water rights, and retiring them permanently so that they can no longer be pumped.
And is it working? You know, how popular is this program?
This was a pilot program, and there were several different entities that received funding from the state to stand up a groundwater rights retirement program. My story focused on the Walker Basin Conservancy in Diamond Valley, but it also occurred in the Humboldt River Basin, and I believe the Southern Nevada Water Authority got an allocation as well. In many places, the program was popular. There actually wasn't enough funding for the amount of demand that there was to retire groundwater rights. And I think one of the really interesting things is that a lot of irrigators that participated, and again, this was a voluntary program, so it wasn't requiring people to retire their groundwater rights or forego their groundwater rights. And what was interesting interviewing people and talking to people is that I really got a sense that there was a really big spectrum of motivations for why people wanted to retire their groundwater rights, which I think was really interesting. In almost all these cases, this was in an agricultural context. And the reasons varied from people felt like they could forego some water and still be pretty efficient with their yields. Other people felt like they were ready to either kind of condense their operations, or this was a good way to ensure that they could have some retirement, maybe do some dryland farming. And then there were people who reinvested the funds that they received from the state into enhancing their operations. So one of the irrigators I talked to in Diamond Valley, they actually purchased a feed store where they can sell and market their hay. So there was just a wide variety of ways that people took advantage of the program and reasons for participating.
Policymakers earlier this year approved legislation aimed at expanding the program. However, it's my understanding that they didn't appropriate any new money to the program. This was originally funded using federal money. What's the future of these buybacks?
So I think that's a really good and open question. I think there is an important conversation to be had about the state's responsibility and the public's role. The reality is that in a lot of these places, there are more rights to use water than there's water to go around. In many cases, regulators I'm not talking about recently, but 40, 50 years ago, deferred doing anything about it. So a lot of irrigators, I think, are looking to the state to step in. And there are programs across the country. Groundwater overuse, overdraft is an issue that Western states are facing. And there are programs that are looking at what does it look like to actually realistically and practically, without a huge amount of legal expense and conflict, get our groundwater basins into balance. And there are programs across the West that, in different ways, because groundwater law is different in different states, are looking at what that transition looks like. And, you know, I can tell you in California, it's a different program, but there's the multi-benefit land repurposing program, which looks at how agricultural land is repurposed to reduce groundwater use, but to also maintain communities, maintain economic bases to ensure resilient economies in these places.
Daniel Rothberg is a journalist whose Substack Invisible Waters focuses on water issues across the Western U.S. You can read his story about rural Nevada groundwater conservation in the current issue of Desert Companion magazine. Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
Catholic Charities of Southern Nevada has been serving meals to food insecure people for six decades. Through its Hands of Hope food pantry, the group projects it will distribute some 3,500 frozen turkeys this Thanksgiving. It recently put out a call for donations from the community, citing the effects of rising food prices as making an unusual heavy impact on vulnerable populations. KNPR's Heidi Kaiser talked with Catholic Charities CEO Sarah Ramirez about the need now and beyond the holidays.
Sarah, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thank you for having me.
So Catholic Charities did issue its call for donations for frozen turkeys and non-perishable food items as well. That was on October 14th. So as we speak today, it's been a couple of weeks. What has the response from the community been?
It's been exceptional. So the community has come out, but I will tell you, the need is still there. And even though our goal is to bring in 3,500 turkeys, last year, the Las Vegas community brought in 4,000. So we're really hoping, even though our goal is 3,500, that they'll go the extra step with us this year.
How many have you gotten so far?
So we've gotten over 1,000, and we still have some time to go, and we anticipate another big round coming in this next week.
And in your call for donations, you said, and I'm quoting here, "It's more evident than ever that the need for support in our city is growing." And you're referring to Greater Las Vegas when you say our city. So Sarah, can you quantify that need for me in terms of maybe average numbers of meals served or some other metric that Catholic Charities tracks?
Absolutely. I can do it in a few ways. So every single day we have a community meal, and that we have been doing for 50 years. Not one day have we missed that meal. On an average, we serve about 450 individuals a day. And in just the last 6 days, we've had a 60% increase, where we are doing 650 to 700 lunches a day. That's just in one of our programs. We also have a food pantry where historically individuals would come to the food pantry and get a few of the supplemental items that they just couldn't afford at the grocery store. Well, that has pivoted since the government shutdown, and we have now become the primary grocery store for many of our families because they don't have any money. And right now what we're seeing, where we would get typically 150 families coming in a day, we're seeing closer to 250.
So you mentioned the government shutdown there. Are there other things that folks who are coming in are citing, just rising food prices in general, or is it specifically the shutdown? What are you hearing from them?
So there's a combination of all the external pressures falling onto families, where before maybe they had, you know, SNAP benefits to where they could get their food needs met, basic food needs met, and they had just enough to pay rent or their utilities. Now that they don't have, they're literally having to choose hunger over heat, hunger over shelter. And so it is compounding on our families. And really important to know, even once the government comes back online, there's going to be residual fallout, and we're going to need our community to step up months afterwards so that we can get families back to pre-government shutdown state, if not better.
So that suggests another question that I wanted to ask you, which is about people think about doing this kind of thing at the holidays, or those who are not in need, let's say, think about being charitable at the holidays. But what does that need look like in, I don't know, April or August? Is it the same?
It really is the same. There's a lot of awareness right now, and we are all very appreciative of that awareness related to food insecurity, housing stability, and the need for family support, right? And so it's getting a lot of publicity right now as it relates to the government shutdown and the compounding. But the reality is our work is 365 days a year. And in April and May, we're still going to have 4,500 people we serve a day, and we just don't have the resources to hire all the staff to do that. And in fact, we would prefer the community to come in and walk alongside us. So those dollars that you might have had to put to the side for salaries or to hire a new person, we can put it to direct client services because a volunteer stepped up and said, yes, and.
So volunteerism is something that's very important.
It is. It is the heartbeat behind the mission.
Sarah Ramirez is the CEO of Catholic Charities of Southern Nevada. And for more information on how to help Catholic Charities and other nonprofits that need it in Nevada, please visit our website at knpr.org. Sarah, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It's Native American Heritage Month, and so far in Southern Nevada, the holiday has been celebrated from the Moapa Band of Paiutes Reservation to the Fort Mojave Indian Reservation. And in Northern Nevada, at UNR's Wells Fargo Auditorium on November 13th, there'll be two films playing starting at 6 p.m., including the documentary Remaining Native by Paige Bethman. Remaining Native tracks a Yerington Paiute tribe member, Coos Stevens, as he confronts the horror of what his great-grandfather went through in a boarding school. Beginning in the late 19th century, the U.S. government tried to assimilate Native children by forcefully placing them in boarding schools. The program has had far-reaching impacts. Stevens created a remembrance run tracking the same route his great-grandfather took to escape the school. KNPR's Jimmy Romo attended a screening of the film and brings us this report. And a note, this four-minute story includes accounts of violence against children.
In 1913, government officials ripped 8-year-old Yerington Paiute tribe member Frank Quinn from his family and placed him in the Stewart Indian Boarding School near Carson City. They did this to strip him from his language, spirituality, and culture. Quinn was one of tens of thousands of Native children taken to U.S. Indian boarding schools, starting at the end of the 19th century. These schools were meant to indoctrinate children into white culture. As a part of her history PhD studies at UNLV, Annie Delgado researches what actually happened to Native children in the U.S. boarding school system.
The early years are just filled with trauma and abuse and pain and just assimilation. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around and fathom the types of evils that was happening in these boarding schools.
The schools, she says, were essentially internment camps where children were physically and sexually assaulted. Most concerning is that untold numbers of children would go missing or be found murdered. Death was so common at boarding schools that cemeteries and unmarked graves are located near campuses. Many students tried to escape the abuse. Frank Quinn fled twice, but both times he was found and taken back to the Stewart Indian School. On his third attempt, however, he made it back home to his family in Yerington. Quinn's great-grandson, Coos Stevens, is the protagonist in the documentary Remaining Native. In the film, viewers learned, along with Stevens, the story of his great-grandfather. It explains why some children were able to escape and others weren't. To remember the courage of Native students who tried to escape, Stevens organized a remembrance run from Yerington to the Stewart Indian School.
Well, a local athlete from a smaller school here in Northern Nevada is getting national attention for what he does both in his sport and for his people.
The first run took place in 2021, followed by three others. The route marked the same 50-mile run Quinn took to go back home.
I'm going to retrace the footsteps of my great-grandfather.
Here's Stevens.
You know, they were running, they were sweating, you know, bleeding. I think of this guy, Russell, who I consider just like an uncle, broke both of his feet, like fractured them by the end of the run. And he did all 50 miles.
Many participants in the first remembrance run did not have the same training as Stevens, who was a track and field athlete at the time.
To see him just put it all out there, I mean, you know, it just shows that it meant so much to him to put himself in the shoes of those kids that were stolen from our tribe.
The documentary is currently on the film festival circuit. It premiered in March, showing in over 55 screenings across the U.S. and Canada. The film has been very well received, said director Paige Bethman.
My intentions with making sure the film was going to reach Native audiences and youth has been really special to see that reaction and have it received with so much love and gratitude that we're able to share Coos' story with so many different communities. It's been really nice.
In 2021, hundreds of unmarked graves were discovered at a former boarding school in Kamloops, Canada. It led to more widespread knowledge of boarding school atrocities and the discovery of unmarked graves at U.S. schools as well. Now, the matter has reached courtrooms. In the most recent class action lawsuit, the Wichita and affiliated tribes and the Washoe tribes of Nevada and California filed a case against the federal government in May. They were suing over misused funds, which had been designated for Native nations but were spent on the federal Indian boarding school system. Currently, the sovereign nations are requesting that the U.S. itemize a $23 billion trust fund, established by pressuring Native nations to sign agreements. Most of the treaties would promise that the U.S. would educate indigenous children in exchange for their land. But that wasn't what happened. Here's UNLV's Annie Delgado again.
The United States government itself knows that these schools did not educate the way they intended to educate.
The communal trauma of boarding schools still affects indigenous families across the nation. Many elders do not want to share what they experienced. But now, many families want to heal. At 21, Stephen has seen a way to start that process.
I think we heal as a community by showing up for one another. There's not enough of that in the world right now.
The film Remaining Native is still available for community screenings. Jimmy Romo, KMPR News.
Before we begin our next segment, we want to let you know it deals with a sensitive topic, suicide. An increasing number of older people are taking their own lives with firearms, according to The Trace, a nonprofit newsroom that studies gun violence. The trend reveals a quiet crisis taking place across the country, and in our state in particular. The Trace's data shows Nevada has the second highest rate of suicide by firearm among older residents. KMPR's Yvette Fernandez talked with Aaron Mendelson of The Trace and others working to reverse the trend.
Aaron, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
I want to begin with a statistic. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, between 2009 and 2023, more than 63,000 older Americans, that's 70 and up, took their lives using a handgun. It's a startling number. Is that what prompted you to examine the data, to put it into context, and to make it public?
Yeah, so I was looking at the rates of suicide by age range, and I was really stunned to see that the age group with the highest rate of suicides in the United States is older Americans, and that basically these rates get higher the older you get. And I just felt like that wasn't a well-understood statistic, and that it was really worth diving into.
And looking at the demographics that The Trace compiled, who is most affected, and do we know why?
Yeah, two great questions. So who is most affected? We know that, and the data is loud and clear. It's older white men. They die by gun suicide at the highest rate. It's a rate more than triple that of Black or Latino men of the same age, and 19 times higher than the rate of women 70 and over. And when you get to the why, that becomes a little bit less clear. The data can often tell us what is happening, but not why that is happening. But there are, you know, some indications that doctors and researchers and folks who work with older adults consistently brought up. These are things like severe illness, financial pressures, isolation, lack of mental health care, difficulty getting medical care, cognitive impairment, and the availability of firearms.
Does this start to happen as they start noticing these changes in their lives, when people still have this cognitive ability to self-analyze?
I can tell you that severe illness, terminal illness in a lot of cases is a real through line. But I think it's also important to emphasize that, you know, experts tell us that suicide is often a very impulsive act, and that if someone doesn't have access to the lethal means, such as a firearm, that most people who attempt a suicide and do not die never attempt it again. This is not a good death. It can leave a real traumatic burden for the family. It can, even in the cases when folks are quite ill, can sort of remove an opportunity for people to connect at the end of life and to provide care for a loved one. So I think it can be an easy thing to look away from, and maybe that's why we don't hear about it more often than we do. But I think it's important to recognize the value that these lives have and talk about alternatives.
And the map in your report shows the western portion of the country has significantly more gun suicides. Sadly, it shows Nevada, in particular northern Nevada, has very high rates. A two-part question here. Why are Nevada's rates so high? And why are the rates among rural white men so high?
The map is loud and clear. We see these really high rates in the western United States. So places like rural Nevada, Wyoming, rural Colorado, parts of Oregon, and far northern California. These are the places with these highest rates of suicide among older adults. And as you say, in particular among older white men. And the data doesn't tell us why we see this trend, but the folks I spoke to said, you know, it's probably partly the sort of frontier mentality, kind of cowboy culture, pull yourself up by your bootstraps way of living that is common in some of these more rural western areas, that access to firearms, when you're talking about the older male piece of it, it might be in part because this is a generation that, for many folks, you know, they didn't grow up having conversations about things like mental health.
What are some of the cultural causes and effects of this problem in the United States in particular, compared with other countries? And does it have anything to do with family or social structures or the American culture?
Yeah, so you can't escape the presence of guns in this conversation. It's the case now that nearly two-thirds of Americans who die as a result of a gunshot are dying by suicide. These are not homicides.
If you had one overriding message before we conclude here, what would that be for the general public to understand about this issue?
Yeah, so part of my reporting was speaking to people who had lost older loved ones to suicide. And I was very struck by a conversation that I had with a woman in Colorado. Her husband, Larry Zentz, died by suicide about 6 years ago. You know, she thinks lives can be saved if we talk about this issue and confront it head on. And there's no one solution to it, but if we don't identify the problem, if we don't name it, can't begin to address it.
Thank you so much, Aaron Mendelson, for joining us and sharing this information.
You bet.
And now I want to turn to a couple of people who have personal perspectives on the issue of gun suicides among older people. Katrina Breeze has been working to get a version of Donna's Law passed across the country, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. Also joining us is Marsha Blake, the executive director of Helping Hands of the Vegas Valley. Katrina and Marsha, welcome to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Katrina, before we begin, I do want to thank you for sharing your experience with us. The law you advocate for is called Donna's Law, as I mentioned earlier, and named after your mother, who took her own life with a handgun about 8 years ago or so. You were an adult at that time. Can you tell us more about her, her personality, and her struggles?
Sure. My mom was fun-loving redhead. She was funny. She was an artist and a teacher. She loved music, and especially the Beatles, and she loved to dance to Cajun music. She had four cats that she really loved, and she had a partner of about 12 years that she was in love with, and a beautiful house. And she had mostly been doing great for years, and then a switch in her medication really changed the trajectory of all of our lives. One of her medications had been working great for bipolar and anxiety, and then stopped working, and then another one was introduced that had a lot of really serious side effects. And suicidality was one of the side effects. And she knew that she was at risk. She did not want to die. She immediately told her psychiatrist and was put into inpatient voluntary care repeatedly. Eventually, we just couldn't get her back into the inpatient care. And she came home, and she, on her phone, searched gun stores near her, and Google showed her the closest gun store, and she went there and she purchased the only gun she ever had and a box of bullets and brought it to the park and shot herself. So this law, Donna's Law, named for her, really gives someone another tool to survive these types of situations by creating a barrier for themselves from impulsive gun purchasing.
It is sort of a legal tool, which we'll talk about in a second also, but I want to bring in Marsha Blake on this. One of the things that Katrina was just talking about is her sense of sort of desperation. Do you see in issues facing older adults this sort of convergence of desperation and a sense of hopelessness as they look at their own circumstances and the future?
Absolutely. So the older adults that we help are low to moderate income. Many of them are solely surviving on Social Security, which is not enough to provide day-to-day living. And for many of them, they've never, ever had to ask for help or use federal assistance to receive just the basic necessities of life. They wouldn't want to be a burden. And so for them, the kindest thing to do for those that they love and care about is to not be that burden instead of asking for help. And we see that all the time with our older adults that we help. They just have that hopelessness of this is never going to get better. There's no way out.
And so for some people, it might be like Katrina was just talking about with her mother, an illness potentially or some kind of thought process. And others, for others, it may be their circumstances, like their economic circumstances that you were talking about, but ultimately all leading to this sort of sense of hopelessness.
And I think for some of them, it's chronic illness. They don't want to be in pain anymore. They know that whatever they have is going to kill them, and they just don't want to suffer. For some of them, it's social isolation. They don't have friends and family that check on them.
Katrina, you said that soon after you began advocating for the passage of Donna's Law, really your aim was to have it become a legal tool across the country. I'm wondering, first of all, if you can just explain briefly, what is Donna's Law and what does it propose to do specifically?
Donna's Law is a voluntary do not sell prohibition that is reversible. So what it does is it enables somebody to put themselves on a list that will make it that they cannot purchase a gun from a licensed dealer. And this whole system already exists. There's already like a red flag system. There's a lot of things that are used to penalize people for criminality. And this is a way to actually provide a life-saving tool by using the same structure that's already there. So if somebody that has self-registered goes to a licensed gun store and they run a background check, the person will be denied. There's no other information that is available. So that prevents people from impulsive gun purchasing.
And one thing you said to me previously, Katrina, is that families are ultimately more powerful than any law. What did you mean by that?
There's so much that families can do. Like, our family had no idea that my mom could just walk into a gun store so close by and purchase a gun. We assumed that because she had just been in a lockup mental health facility, that wasn't possible. So just educating ourselves, knowing what guns exist in our families and being brave enough to have the conversations.
Thank you. Katrina Breeze is a gun suicide prevention activist, and Marsha Blake is the executive director of Helping Hands of Vegas Valley. Katrina, Marsha, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And earlier we also heard from Aaron Mendelson of The Trace, and we'll have a link to The Trace's suicide prevention resource guide on our website at knpr.org. And if you or a loved one needs help, you can dial 988 for the 24/7 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline or visit 988lifeline.org for a live chat.
You know him as a regular guest on NPR's news quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. But did you know he's also a Nevadan? Last year, comedian Alonzo Bowden moved from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. Not that he's always hanging out at the neighborhood bar. Besides his appearances on Wait Wait, he's constantly doing stand-up at venues around the country. Bowden has a homecoming run of dates November 17th through the 23rd at the Comedy Cellar at the Rio. State of Nevada producer Mike Bravatt spoke to him recently about Las Vegas, comedy, the news, and the intersections of all those things. Here's that conversation.
Alonzo, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thank you.
I understand you are a big motorcycle enthusiast, and you have been living here for, I think, about 18, 19 months. And so I don't have to tell you what our roads are like. I'm just wondering how you contend with Las Vegas drivers when you ride around the valley.
Oh, the funniest thing here is every street is under construction.
Yes.
I don't know who the orange cone guy is. I know he is the richest man in the city. He's making a fortune. Sometimes I think it's all cones and it's just a maze. You have to figure it out. The drivers, they're kind of fascinating how bad some people drive. Two things make me laugh. One is when there's a green for a left turn and it turns yellow, people don't turn. They don't understand they can still turn on the yellow. And then one day I saw a truck just pull out of a driveway and it was a right turn only. So he just drove over the median and made a left.
Oh, no.
And I was like, oh, so we're just making our own rules now. So.
Well, all that notwithstanding, what do you love about Las Vegas enough that you left Los Angeles for it?
Vegas is low key. Vegas is a lot more relaxed, a lot less crowded. I think my first morning in Vegas, I called a friend in L.A. I said, guess what I'm doing? And they were like, what are you doing? I said, I'm doing 70 miles an hour at 9 a.m., which is unheard of in LA. 70 miles an hour is only done between 2 and 4 a.m. on alternate freeways. Giving up the traffic and stuff, that was one thing. And then, you know, I have a dog. There's a lot of parks here. It's just a more relaxed, it's a more relaxed life, more low key.
Now, Alonzo, as a journalist, I keep hearing people say, hey, I'm tired of the news. I'm burned out by it all. And yet the program that you are a panelist for, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, continues to be popular. From your perspective as a regular panelist, why is that show so appealing despite the current state of the news and the fatigue that's associated with it?
A, we don't make it funny. I mean, we do make it funny. And B, we don't do horrible stories. When you watch the regular news, it becomes tiring. Look, even for me, and part of my job is staying up on the news, it just becomes so repetitive and ridiculous and tiring. You just get worn out. So Wait Wait is a break from that. They get funny stories and offbeat stuff, and we laugh at it. It's a break from reality.
Is that one of the reasons why you've been on it for 15 years and counting?
As long as they call me, I'll do the show. I always have a good time doing it. Still never know what to expect. That's the number one question people ask about the show. Do we get the questions in advance? No.
I wonder how much of your stand-up career and your Wait Wait role are connected. Like, for instance, you ever come up with like an improvised line on Wait Wait, and then maybe you, I don't know, secretly scribble it down and figure out a way to work it into your routine, or maybe even something vice versa. Is there a connection there?
I'll bet that hasn't happened 10 times in 15 years.
Mm.
Because Wait Wait, and one of the things I like about it, it's all improv, right? It's comedy in the moment, and it's funny under that circumstance. So when you go to a stand-up stage, I don't have Peter asking me the question. I'm not commenting on a comment that, you know, Paula Poundstone made or something like that. So it's two different types of comedy. Once in a while, I'll say something or come up with something that'll lead to a bit and it'll enter my stand-up act. But the biggest crossover are the fans. NPR fans come see my stand-up, which I really appreciate. NPR nerds, takes a while to get them. But once they like you, they stick with you.
I have read from audience members who, you know, are talking about NPR online that they go to the taping of the show, and one of them reported that the show is actually edgier and maybe less radio friendly than the version that's edited for broadcast. Is that true?
The live show takes 2 hours. The broadcast is 50 minutes. Does that answer your question?
Sounds like there's a lot of room to fill is what you're saying, right?
They definitely edit. We do some things that they say don't work on radio, like when we do callbacks from other jokes, because they say if someone tuned into the show in the middle, they'll miss it.
Sure.
Faith Saley is filthy. We always have to censor Faith. Oh, it's just sometimes I blush. Paula will get on a roll and they have to shorten it. I've been known to get on a roll and have to shorten it. I've definitely done some black jokes that they're like, yeah, this is NPR. We can't broadcast that one. So there's some editing done. We shoot it on Thursday. They edit Friday. It airs Saturday and Sunday. And I tell all Wait Wait fans, if you can, see a live show, because you'd love to see the parts that get edited out.
In 2020, you said in an interview that the news cycle is so full that I can't keep up. And it feels even fuller 5 years later, if I'm speaking frankly. How do you process what's happening to prepare for Wait, Wait, or even your stand-up routine?
My problem now is we don't move forward. The ridiculous stuff happens so fast. Like, you could be writing a joke about something Trump said, and he will say something else. You know, then we have Christy Noem, RFK, and, you know, it's literally... People say it's comedy gold. No, it's comedy mud. You're buried in it. There's so much of it. And you have to figure out what's funny, what you're going to say. During the first Trump administration, they actually came up with a rule on Wait, Wait, only one Trump joke per show, because the whole show would have been just that. So when I say I get tired of it, there are other things. I wish we would come up with some new issues. I can give you a healthcare joke that I wrote 10 years ago. It's still funny because we haven't moved forward in healthcare and, you know, things like that. Those are the kind of the frustrating things as a comic, because as a comic, I don't want to say the same thing over and over. I don't want to tell the same jokes over and over again, you know?
Now, I know you joke around about a lot of different things in your routine, but how much of your current stand-up repertoire is focused on the news?
I'm consciously trying to do more personal material, but I would say it's 60-40 news and personal.
Are there areas of the news that you tend to go back to the most for your material?
Well, I'll tell you, my biggest outrage is the press, because the press doesn't ask questions that they should be asking. And we all know that, like, when a politician's standing up there telling a blatant lie, for example, when Mike Johnson stands up there and says that the shutdown is the fault of the Democrats, and the reporter pulled, I don't know what they're doing, and it's like, okay, let me get this straight. Republicans have the White House, the House, the Senate, and the Supreme Court is pretty much bought and paid for. Yet, mysteriously, the Democrats are in charge of everything. How? And why doesn't someone ask him that question? Like, are you that weak that you can't stand up even though you have the power? You know, questions that we want to ask.
You probably have tried and true ways to find the humor in what we would call bad news. It sounds like you kind of know what to mine for if you do want to use a topic and go with it.
So that's the gift. That's the part I can't explain, that I look at something and I see what's funny. That's how comedians work. We see what's funny that the general public doesn't. I don't know any comic that can explain that. I think that's the gift. Just like musicians are born, you know, with a certain creativity with their instrument, or someone's born with the ability to sing, and they're like, they can learn more about it, they can become more musical, but that innate gift to sing they were born with, we see the world funny. If you ask me, how do I see the world funny? I'm like, I got it from my mom. I inherited it. She was hilarious. I call that the gift. That's the part I can't explain.
You know, my Instagram and Facebook feeds are full of stand-up comedy reels, and it has introduced me to some comedians. In fact, somebody that you're playing with at the Comedy Cellar here in Vegas, Jason Chaney, I discovered that way. And I'm wondering, how much of a role has social media played in your stand-up career since it became a big thing in our lives?
So it helps me, but it's very funny. It's kind of the generation after me. So I started in 93, which was right after Carson. You know, all the comics in the 80s, Carson made you famous, made you rich. So I started in 93. I missed Carson. And then the social media thing probably really started blowing up, say, around 2005, 2007, 2008. Yeah. So, yeah, I was too young for one, too old for the other, and landed in the middle. And thank you for reminding me. Thank you for reminding me why.
As I said earlier, you're playing the Comedy Cellar at the Rio this week. You've played Brad Garrett's Comedy Club a lot in the past. Are you picky about where you'll play, or are you the kind of person where, you know, hey, a paying gig is a paying gig?
Oh, yeah. If they're hiring, I'm telling jokes. See, Vegas is a unique city. There are some cities, like say you're in, I don't know, St. Louis, right? And there are two comedy clubs. And the clubs might be, hey, you either work Club A or Club B. You can't do both because they're both mining from the same audience, right? But Vegas, it's a new audience every week. The tourists, it's constant transition. So if you work Brad's Club 1 week and then you work the Cellar another week and then you work the Strat another week, it's three different audiences. You're not pulling from the same audience. So the clubs, they don't have that same objection to you working other clubs.
That kind of begs a question. Are you also a fan of comedy as an audience member? Do you go to these clubs to see maybe who the new talent is in your industry?
No, why would I want to see who's replacing me?
Alonzo Bowden is a comedian and the longtime panelist on the news quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which you can hear Saturdays at 9 a.m. right here or wherever you listen to KNPR. And he's going to be at the Comedy Cellar at the Rio November 17th through the 23rd. And we'll have a link for tickets at knpr.org.
I will be uncensored at the Cellar. I will not be limited by Peter Sagal's ridiculous questions.
You heard it here. Thanks, Alonzo.
Thank you, guys.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR producer Mike Bravatt, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
Vegas Theater Company has a unique series happening this month. What's going on?
It's called Solos, and as the title suggests, these are one-person affairs. VTC has done a great job at offering a variety of shows, and just take this week's offerings into account. On Friday, local singer Kelly Clinton has an autobiographical music-centric show. On Saturday and Monday, local theater mainstay Maitani Washington revives her Mother Tongue. That's a show about family, culture, and heritage that she debuted in June at the Fallout Fringe Festival. Then on Saturday and Sunday nights, we have the experimental theater of Ernest Hemming's Test Market, a concept that isn't just Ernest on stage, but also Ernest executing the production alone as well. And then on Sunday, we have Eric Travis Wilson's memoir, Come to Life, and it's called Prostate Cancer, the Musical. And yeah, that's a comedy.
That is a lot to choose from.
Yeah, and there's other shows later this month as well. And Solos is through November 24th at Vegas Theater Company.
Meanwhile, over at Clark County Government Center's Rotunda Gallery, there's something more somber.
Yes, The Choices of Man Through the Lens of the Holocaust is the name of the exhibit, and it's curated by the Nevada Center for Humanities Nevada Holocaust Museum. And of course, the title alone suggests a heaviness. On the other hand, the show's central focus is that of the upstander, the witnesses who stand up for the persecuted.
So how does it tell their stories?
So it's through photography and other artifacts, and sometimes those upstander actions tend to be small, everyday actions and gestures. The timing of this is noteworthy. November 9th marked the 87th anniversary of Kristallnacht, which is when the violent pogroms by the Nazis against the Jews began. But with anti-Semitism growing and the viral videos and photos circulating of regular folks confronting ICE agents who are pulling people from cars and arresting U.S. citizens, the relevance of this exhibit is glaring. And you can see this at the Government Center through January 29th. That's Monday through Thursdays from 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m.
From historic parallels to cultural ones, what does Vegas City Opera have to say about celebrities and influencers?
Well, so much that they worked them into their adaptation of George Frideric Handel's Baroque opera, Semele. This has got to be the epitome of great art. When something shows a reflection of life, no matter where it is on the timeline, this opera's cast will portray Semele, Jupiter, and other notables of Greek mythology as their reality TV and Hollywood equivalents. And this is all backed by the Las Vegas Sinfonietta's 30-odd member ensemble. And if they can pull this off, I'm hoping for a Homerian version of Survivor for their next production. And this is all staged November 16th at Clark County Library.
Finally, we've got an event to recommend in Reno. Who is Twanguero?
It's the stage name of Spanish guitarist Diego Garcia. Twanguero is most known for his multi-genre approach to the guitar. The base of his performance is Spanish classical finger-picking style, but then he throws in dashes of Latin and surf and rockabilly and jazz, and it's giving his approach a very international sound.
And what does his name, Chuanguero, refer to?
It's his aesthetic, and he calls it Latin twang. NPR Music once said that his music finds, quote, a spot somewhere between the flamenco music on which he was raised and the low percussive rumble of 50s era Duane Eddy. I consider that an easy sell, especially to guitar aficionados. And Chuanguero plays UNR's Foundation Arts Recital Hall on November 13th. And here's a bonus. He'll conduct an outreach session earlier that afternoon at the John and Geraldine Lilly Museum of Art, where you can ask him pretty much whatever you want.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Paul.